Welcome to the Aquarimax Audio Show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
This is episode 153, recorded March 4th, 2013.
Greetings, Aquarimaxers.
Good evening. We are here with you once again, and we hope you all enjoyed the interview last week with Diana Wahlstad.
Several of you sent in very positive comments, so we're glad it was a hit. And actually, I didn't mention, but Diana emailed me recently to just say that she had listened to the podcast and thought it went well.
Oh, good. I'm glad she's pleased with how it came out.
Me too. I thought it was
yeah,
good.
Yeah, it was a nice one. Well, we have several people in the queue tonight. We may or may not get through everything, but anything that we don't get through, we'll get through next week, so no worries. We've got Robert in Florida, and Kelsey in Arizona, and Juliet in Paris, and Tony in New York, and Adam in Santa Rosa, and Mick in Carnforth, and Tom in Provo.
Quite a lineup.
Quite, indeed. So, let's start with Robert in Florida.
Okay, I think this is his first contribution that I know
of. Oh, okay, well, great.
I think so.
Welcome, Robert.
Perhaps not, but I think so.
He says, your lighting show was pretty good, but you neglected one important aspect, operating costs.
Very true. We didn't really mention that so
much. That's true. We've kind of skipped that part.
Yes.
Not much of a factor when you only have a 10-gallon aquarium, but the cost increases rapidly the more aquariums you have and the more important that the plants become. The newer fluorescent lights, T5 and T8, are by far the least expensive to operate.
They're quite efficient. Mm-hmm. So, Robert, thank you for mentioning that. I should have mentioned that, but now that you have, that helps round things out a bit, so we appreciate that.
I don't know, the more intense lights, like the marine lights and stuff, are they more expensive?
Do you mean to run or do you mean to purchase?
Well, to run, of course, they're more expensive to purchase.
Well, they're very, yeah, the marine lighting tends to be pretty expensive to purchase, but also they can be expensive to run, partly because in many cases you're not just running bulbs, but you're also running cooling devices to take care of them. Sorry, that was a
microphone adjustment.
Well, microphone stand adjustment anyway.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sorry for the squeakiness.
But okay. Yeah, very good point. Thank you, Robert, for bringing
anything
that
else
up.
You want to say about cost of operating?
No, I think it's just good that he brought that up and
keep an eye on your electrical bill.
Yes, it's important to pay attention to that.
Okay, we're going to go to Kelsey in Arizona, who used to be Kelsey in California. In fact, the subject of moving from California to Arizona was what Kelsey first contacted us about. And so now she has written back to kind of fill us in on how that journey went with all of the fish.
Yes. So why don't you narrate a bit for us?
So, excuse me. She says, I had few options due to very limited funds, but amazingly, all the fish made it. The whole of our worldly possessions had to fit into our Jeep Cherokee. It was a tight squeeze. Our linens were packed into the empty 29-gallon tank, and the fish, a happy community of 5 adorable Sturbycories, 4 male guppies, and 7 rummy-nosed tetras, were in a small 2.5-gallon, half-moon plastic tank nestled atop the linens in the tank. Besides the fish, the 2.5-gallon tank had a moss ball and some jamba fern, which I figured would possibly help the fish be a tiny bit less stressed. Filtering this tiny 2.5-gallon was my AquaClear 50. I had a smaller spare filter that would have been more size-appropriate, but I ran this one because I needed my bacteria to live, and I knew even if I put the media in a bag of tank water, it wouldn't survive the 16-hour drive, and I knew I didn't want to recycle my tank. Can't say as we blame you.
Right, recycling a tank is very difficult.
Yes.
In such a situation.
Mm-hmm. So I stuck the AC50 on the 2.5-gallon tank and fed the cord up to the front of the Jeep via a narrow tunnel through our stuff. This sounds like certain car trips we've taken too. So the cord could reach the power inverter plugged into the cigarette lighter. The power inverter was about $8 at Fry's Electronics for anyone who needs to run a filter in a car. Much cheaper, I think, than buying battery-run versions of your equipment. I agree.
And we've used inverters like that to power air pumps and things like that when we're traveling with sensitive creatures.
Moving and things like that. Well, it's a good investment.
It is a good way to do it. Mm-hmm.
Every time we had to stop, I had to unplug the cord for fear of killing the battery, which meant I had to sometimes reprime the pump. The fish obviously did not enjoy being packed into a 2.5-gallon tank, but there was more than adequate filtration, and I did a water change when we had to stop at a hotel. In case the hotel frowned upon fishy guests in room, we carried the tank up half full under a blanket. We met an employee as we neared our room, and he looked at us oddly as we sloshed down the hall, refusing eye contact. He said nothing, thankfully.
I had a very vivid mental image as I was reading that. It was, it was kind of fun.
Adventures in fish keeping.
Done things like that before.
Mm-hmm. Once we got to our new home, I found that the water's pH was quite different, of course. It was about 7.6 or 7.8, compared with the fish's normal 7.4. So I drip acclimated them over the next 72 hours. A long time, but I had to leave them in the 2.5 gallon until everything was ready in the big one. In the end, when I finally got the temperature and the pH equalized in the big tank, I netted the fish into their new old home, and within 10 hours, everybody was back to their normal coloring. Even the rummies have fire red faces in the high pH. Which is great.
Yeah, sounds like everybody made the journey. And I think it's a pretty good way to handle things, considering the restrictions and situations that they were doing. A really good way to do it.
And she says, throughout the ordeal, they swam vigorously and seemed all right, and after extensive acclimation, they have continued to thrive. Everybody's appetite and behavior is normal, and it's been a week now.
Yeah, so that sounds great. So far so good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say one nice thing about the AquaClears, as well as with some other filters, you can often turn down the flow somewhat, which you might do, she may have done in that occasion. Because in a 2.5 gallon tank, you know, you don't need the full flow of that filter.
Right.
And if you turn it down a bit, it still will allow the bacteria to get some oxygen, so.
It's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty.
And thank you for sharing, Kelsey.
Thank you, Kelsey.
That's a nice success story that can, I think, help other people think about some good options when they're moving.
That's good. Okay, we have heard from Juliet, and she has sent us a few more details to help get to the bottom of the shrimp problem. She says, in the 20-gallon, there are about 15 red cherries, 2 autos, 3 amanos, and 3 adult endlers, and 4 fry. Not exactly a population explosion, but I'm pretty sure the amanos are clearing out the shrimplets. The endlers have only been in there 3 weeks after I cracked their tank. Ouch! So even if they eat shrimplets, they did not create the problem. I cannot get moss to grow in any of my tanks. Probably it's too hot, about 26 degrees Celsius. Either it gets choked with algae or it just withers away. Water's very hard in that one, 8.3. Only one neon. Fine for Anubias, but Java ferns barely survives and the moss just dies. Do you think it's more about the hardness or the temperature?
Well, moss really does prefer cooler water. I would say I've grown various mosses in pretty hard water. I mean, I can't say for sure because there may be other things going on with their water too, but
maybe
on the other hand,
I've
had moss do really fairly well at warmer water, but all other things being equal, moss does do a lot better in cooler water.
Okay. She goes on to say, I'm pretty sure that people who manage to breed cherries with amanos have lots of moss. I have lots of Anubias, and they are just not good enough to hide babies from predators. I would love to grow moss, but unfortunately cannot get any of the species that can stand warmer temperatures. I was told that cherries stopped breeding at low temperatures, but at what temperature does that happen? I guess I'm committing the newbie error of slightly overheating and slightly overfeeding. What do you think?
Well, the heat does, like we said, it can be a problem for the moss. And keeping the shrimp too cool, I think you'd have to be pretty cool to do that, like an unheated sort of tank. If you're in the low 70s somewhere, I think they're going to be fine. They should reproduce there. I've had shrimp reproducing at those temperatures without any trouble.
Okay. Is that about what 26 degrees Celsius works out to Fahrenheit?
Well, that's around 78 degrees Fahrenheit, which is fairly warm, but it's not outrageously warm for shrimp. I don't think that should be
certainly not low
problem.
Enough that they would stop breeding.
No, in fact, you can have that quite a bit lower than that, and they should be fine.
Okay.
So, I'm puzzled about that.
She says also, in the 4-gallon nano, I have 11 green cherry shrimp, a bunch of snails, and 2 assassins, added recently to get rid of the snails. again, it's 26 degrees Celsius, so about 78, 79 degrees Fahrenheit, and a sponge filter. RO water and a pH of about 7.6. And she asks, do you think that shrimp are affected by seasonal changes like air pressure, and is that what you would call it? Yeah, I guess the air pressure. Right?
Yeah.
As it does affect some amphibians, even though they are kept in artificial light and temperature ranges. Maybe they will start breeding in the spring. What do you think? Do other people shrimp breed in the winter months as much as they do in the summer?
Well, that's something that I think Mick and And Adam had some comments about that. But it's not unplausible. It could be that there's something going on there. I don't know. It seems to me that the shrimp that we're talking about come from China. So, and I believe it's southern China. But they're going to have some seasonal variations there, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an interesting idea. It would be interesting to see. But I think it was Mick who was saying he was having a similar problem with some of his shrimp. And Adam had an idea as well. So we'll hold off on that for now.
Get to those.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. She also asks, does overlighting affect them? I have no timer, and I'm spending hours away from home working. There are many days when they get light from 8 in the morning until 10 at night. In birds, this would probably encourage them to lay, but with shrimp, who knows?
Hmm. You know what? I wonder if the if it's an irregular photo period, that could be throwing them off.
Irregular meaning,
like if it's from 8 to 10 some days, and it's from 8 to 8 other days, and, you know, something like that. Because it sounded like the way she worded that wasn't consistent.
Wasn't every day, yeah.
So it is possible that lighting could be throwing them off.
Maybe a timer would be a useful thing.
I would say if you can get
in
a timer and it doesn't cost too much, I'd go ahead and put one on and give that a try.
Okay. She says, I used to have 10 red cherries in that same tank that rapidly became 50 or more, so it's definitely not overpopulation. I rather like sparsely populated tanks, less risk of accidents and ammonia spikes. I like the jungle look with little animals going discreetly about their business rather than a great crowd of fish. I love that phrase. Going discreetly about their fishy business.
I like that too.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of this, it seems rather unfair that we try our hardest to keep our tanks well-balanced with few fish, proper water changes, etc., and yet lose some to infections or ammonia spikes. Well, is it every Chinese restaurant around here has a tank barely 3 feet long, holding 2 or 3 10-inch long koi and Oscars the size of a football that can't even turn around properly, and yet have been in there for more than 2 years and are still alive. I repeat, not fair. But this is funny, because Russ and I were just discussing this.
Yeah.
The other night.
There was this little Vietnamese cafe we used to visit.
In Provo, actually.
Yeah, and it was, it was probably not much bigger than a 55-gallon. It may have been a little bit bigger, but not much. Maybe a 75 or 65 or something, I don't know. I don't remember. But at any rate, they had one of those grossly overpopulated tanks.
Like, how many fish were in there? I mean, rubbing scales with your neighbor the whole time,
yeah,
you know?
It was hard to turn
and
around.
And they were big.
And they didn't
like 2 feet long, big.
They didn't look terribly happy, but we'd come back few months later and all the same fish were in there.
They were still going.
Yeah. Well, I think one key that Juliet hit upon there is 2 years, she said, didn't she?
At the restaurants?
Yeah. I think she used the
term. More than 2 years and are still alive,
More than 2 years and
are
still alive. Well, the thing is, you know, koi can live to be decades and decades, and in fact, mm-hmm. on occasion have surpassed, I think there's at least one documented case of one surpassing 200 years.
Mm-hmm. Which is pretty amazing.
Yeah, I very much doubt that these fish in the restaurants are really actually reaching their full
lifespan.
Potential for lifespan, right. But they can, they're amazingly hardy and can sometimes survive outrageously poor conditions for a short amount of time. So even if that's 5 years, you know, it's a while, but it's not anything like what they could
do. It's a fraction of what they could live to.
Yeah, fraction of their potential. So,
mm-hmm.
But it is funny. It really is. It reminds me that my parents' friends have this awful story about a goldfish they had in a container that was just big enough for it to... It couldn't even turn around. It could just barely, you know,
wiggle
flick
its fins.
Pectoral fins. And it just stayed alive forever in there, and it's ridiculous.
Why didn't they get a bigger container?
I don't know. But anyway, sometimes they survive the most outrageous things, and then when we give them all the care that we can, they have a hard time. It's frustrating. So
okay.
we commiserate with you,
yes.
Your pain, and hopefully we'll be able to, we or someone else will be able to shed some light on that shrimp.
In fact, Tony now has a comment for Juliet.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure if it's about this or not, but there you said there were a couple of things coming up that
right.
had to do with the shrimp. So Tony says, Juliet, thanks for warning me away from trying red cherry shrimp in the Zebra Danio tank. Perhaps some more peaceful fish. I recall that you're fond of endlers. You keep them in the shrimp tank, and do they eat the shrimp? Oh, which is what we were just
right.
kind of going
she
over.
Was saying
she
the
said,
Milano shrimp were
yeah.
probably doing it more than the endlers,
than
because the endlers were there
okay.
of only a short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But that's a good comment, Tony, yeah. so thanks for bringing that up.
And then he says to all the rest of us, here's my question for all the shrimp keepers out there. I am noticing quite a few seed shrimp in my 6.6 red cherry shrimp tank. now. They're pretty cool, but now I'm thinking about adding some sort of fish in order to munch down their numbers a bit. Could endlers be the answer, or perhaps another fish? Of course, the trick is finding something that would enjoy eating the tiny ostropods yet be fairly forgiving of the red cherries. If I don't find a solution, I am sure I'll be happy to live with having sea shrimp in the shrimp tank.
Hmm. Good, good question. I bet endlers are a good bet.
Is that why he was maybe asking?
Yeah, that's a good idea, yeah. I would say. But we'll see what Juliet says and others, what they say.
It does seem rather unlikely that if they would eat the seed shrimp, they'd leave the baby shrimp alone.
Right, but the seed shrimp are a bit smaller.
So maybe if it was a really small fish, they wouldn't want to eat the shrimp?
And endlers, just, they're not
that's
very big.
True,
they're
pretty
diminutive,
little.
Guppy size approximately. So
that's true.
It's probably the best bet in terms of fish, or one of the best bets in terms of fish.
Okay. So, and more shrimp. More shrimpy questions.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Adam in Santa Rosa. But I think before we get to Adam, we will take our break.
Okay, let's have a break.
Let's have a break.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Piscy Now.
Okay, so we're going to go to Adam in Santa Rosa, which is in California. And he was actually wondering about light affecting shrimp breeding as well.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I was wondering if the photo period can change how the shrimp will breed. About a year ago, I converted my 10-gallon into a planted shrimp tank. I got some of the easier plants, like Java fern and some crypts, because I was using this stock 20-watt light, and I was afraid that the plants would not get enough light. I overcompensated for this by leaving the lights on for something like 18 hours a day. During this time, my 10 cherry shrimp did not breed at all. That's interesting.
It is.
Yeah. Over the next couple of months, they slowly died off. I ordered 20 more and the same thing happened. No babies and slowly dying shrimp. I would occasionally see a buried female, but she always dropped her egg shortly after. Eventually, I decided to drop the photo period to about 12 hours. Within a month, I had a tank full of saddled or buried females and was starting to get babies. As far as I can tell, nothing else changed in the tank. It is a shrimp-only tank with good hiding places and a sponge filter. Is this just a coincidence, or do cherries react to the photo period?
Oh, I see a study on the horizon.
Somebody do a thesis.
But that could very well apply to Juliet's case. Mm-hmm. So.
I don't think she's got it on for 18.
Well, no, but
she's
did
had
say
it on
she,
for like 14.
14, but 14 and difference between 14 and 12 could be significant.
Yeah, it's two hours.
It's worth a shot.
Maybe she drops it down to 10 or 12.
Yeah,
see
I'd say
what
get a timer and do it like we were saying before, but with...
That'd be interesting to see what happens.
Adam's situation... although not empirical, does kind of point us in that direction as a possibility. So thank you, Adam.
That's helpful. That's really helpful.
Yeah, it's worth a try.
He also says he was wondering about scuds.
Mm-hmm.
I picked some up with a shipment of plants. The population recently boomed because of some overfeeding. I started reading about them, and there were a lot of people saying that they will eat baby shrimp. Any thoughts?
They are pretty opportunistic feeders. I mostly noticed them munching on plant material, but I've seen them on fish food and stuff too, so I guess it's possible. I've never actually seen it happen, so
tell,
I can't
tell
really
us exactly what scuds are.
Amphipods.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Scuds is a common name given to freshwater amphipods too.
Okay.
So, I mean, specifically, I've heard it referred to freshwater ones. But anyway, I can't really comment one way or the other on that because I've never seen it happen, but
possibly.
If you follow the rule that if it can eat something, it will eventually eat something, then it makes sense that it could. I don't really think of them as predators, but rather just more scavengers, but I guess, anything's possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think it's very interesting, the photo period thing.
Yeah, that is. I would love to set up some tanks and do an empirical study on that, but can't.
When we get some space, maybe.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, so thank you, Adam, for chiming in. Okay, Mick. He says, "Hi guys, there is a picture and video of my setup for the cave tetras. The quarries have finally started to settle down a bit and behave more like catfish than torpedoes. I was up in the night last week and noticed that the cave tetras had not quite gone into a state of rest like you would normally see, but they were very subdued and just moving around very slightly near the bottom of the tank. I suppose that as they are born with eyes, which then cataract over, they must still be able to detect an amount of light difference other than that which the pineal picks up."
That kind of makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
They have some sort of residual ability to sense light, even if it's not images, just a little bit of the difference between light and dark.
Well, even if you think about it, I mean, people, if we close our eyes, we can still tell when somebody turns the light off.
Yeah, and if it's just a thin layer of fairly unpigmented skin and scales, it makes sense that they would be able to see something, unless their eyes actually degenerate to the point where they can't anymore. I don't know. And there are some other interesting things about that, though, that reminds me of. You know, they've done studies on blind cave tetras and how they sleep?
How do they sleep?
They found that they sleep much less than their sighted relatives of the same species.
Oh, why is
basically
that?
Basically, they are just a variety, they're a variety of the Mexican tetra.
Okay.
That, you know, the populations that live in caves, and in fact, there are several populations that arose independently in different cave systems of the same species.
I did not know that.
And they've done some studies on them, and they've determined that they have a gene that regulates their sleep patterns, and that's apparently a dominant gene because they've crossed sighted fish with the blind form of the fish.
Uh-huh.
And they find that the young, even if though they have eyes, they sleep the same way that their cave-dwelling ancestors did.
The gene makes them not need sleep?
Not sleep as much. Yeah.
Do they still need to sleep? Do they live not as long because they're just tired?
I don't know how it relates to lifespan, but
it just makes them not need to sleep as much.
Well, that's a question I don't know exactly how to answer, but I can tell you that they do sleep a lot less.
Huh.
Which I thought was interesting. And the idea, and I wish I could remember where this is from, but if you Google cavefish and sleep and insomnia, you know, something like that, put that all together, they figure that it's an adaptation to living in caves where the food sources are limited, you know, like bat droppings is one of their main sources of food. And if you're asleep, you're likely to miss food when it becomes available.
Hmm.
And so it's an adaptation.
How do you adapt to just less sleep? Because people could just try to sleep less, but we would just be tired. We wouldn't produce young that don't need to sleep less.
Right, but the idea, I guess, is that it's a mutation that occurs, and it actually allows them to survive in that situation. So, very interesting stuff.
That's pretty crazy.
And I really like to make setup. I don't know if I've shown you the video.
I have not seen the video yet. Did you put it up on the Facebook page yet?
No, but we'll put it up on the show page, and we can put it up on the Facebook page. And it's pretty cool.
Okay.
I like the setup. The hardscape's really nice. It's got some large light-colored rocks and some different things set up. Mm-hmm. And when they're swimming there, it looks really cool. So it's like I say, I always want to set up a tank like that. So at least I can vicariously have Mick's tank.
You know? you can live through Mick, right?
Yeah.
So we'll get that up on the pages and so everybody else can see it too. So thank you, Mick, for sending that in.
Yeah.
Okay, we have our last one. We got through everything. How
That's
about
amazing.
That? We're not even out of time yet.
I must have forgotten something.
It's okay. It's Tom in Provo. And he says he enjoyed the interview with Diana Wahlstedt, too.
Good.
It's a great interview. Living in Provo, where the water is very hard, I am having no trouble keeping my tank with a pH of slightly below 8. I would like, however, to expand to a second tank for tetras and other fish that prefer soft, slightly acid water, and there seem to be a number of them. I am uncertain, however, of the best way to create and maintain that kind of environment. I would like the new tank to be planted. I also have an RO unit and could mix RO water with my treated tap water to reduce hardness and perhaps pH, but that would get me only partway at best, especially since I would be losing buffering capacity. Adding driftwood to the tank, filtering through peat, or using CO2, are sometimes recommended, but I'm wondering about the stability of the resulting pH. Sorry, guys. I'm getting over a cold, so my throat's getting to the end of being able to talk here. I have read, and I think I heard you say, that fluctuations in pH are more harmful than a pH that is too high or too low. How quickly does pH rise when CO2 is stopped? Minutes, hours, days? Does simply planting a tank have any effect on pH? What is meant by slightly acid? And in general, what is the best way to keep a stable, slightly acid pH in an aquarium?
Hmm.
All good questions.
They are good questions. Well, let's look at this. I would say that you're definitely right about the fluctuation in pH being more harmful than pH being a little too high or a little too low. And a couple of ways to, in terms of how quickly does pH rise when CO2 is stopped? Well, it depends on a lot of things. It depends on the flow of water in the tank. It depends on how many plants you have in the tank and how much lighting they're getting and how many nutrients are going in terms of how the plants might affect it. But the amount of surface agitation is a biggie. That'll change it a lot. So it's hard to say. Okay, if you're assuming that plants aren't having much of an effect, you have a tank with few or no plants in it, and you are having CO2 just to keep the pH down or whatever, which I guess is an unusual situation. Most people probably wouldn't do that, but let's say that's what you're doing. Then the CO2 will change the pH within a couple of hours. I mean, that's ballpark sort of figure. And depending on the efficiency of, you know, the way you're dissolving the CO2 and all kinds of stuff. But yeah, within a couple of hours it'll change.
Okay, and then if you do have plants that are making a difference?
Mm-hmm.
A day or just more hours?
Well, if you have a whole bunch of plants that are growing, have all the nutrients they need, and they're getting plenty of light, they pull a lot of CO2 out of the water. And they can make a difference faster, I guess. I mean, in a few hours, like in the interview I had with Diana Wallstadt, she was talking about in the morning. You start out, if you light the tank at 8 in the morning, by 11 o'clock in the morning, they've sucked all the CO2, the available CO2, mm-hmm. out of the water. So plants definitely have an effect in terms of that, how much CO2 is in the water, and the CO2 does have an effect on the pH. The more CO2 dissolved in the water, the lower the pH.
Okay, so if they suck it all out, the pH goes up?
Yes.
Sorry, I always still ask you about this because this is not stuff that I really get yet.
No,
so
it's okay.
I figure there's probably other people listening who also don't get it.
No,
so
it's good to ask about it. And slightly acid is sort of a vague term, but it usually means, you know, anything below pH of 7, but not much below pH of 7, because 7 being neutral, you know, anything under that is
okay.
going to be acid. So if you're just under that, say 6, 8, 6, 9.
That's slightly acid?
Yeah. Right in there, that could be slightly acid. And it is a vague term and would vary depending on who's using it and what they're meaning and things like that. But I would say he wants to know what the best way to keep a stable, slightly acid pH in the aquarium is. Well, I would say if you want to reduce the pH in a stable manner, you do lose buffering capacity when you're mixing RO water with tap water, but a lot of people have good results with it. And you could get far enough to do fairly well. If you just diluted your tap water halfway with RO water, you could make a difference. You'd see where your pH is. And if you're doing regular water changes, so you're constantly replacing the buffers, then you could do okay. It wouldn't be too bad. I've noticed that with the local water here, if I run CO2 injection on a tank, just do it yourself, yeast reactor, that I can keep it on all the time, and it's stable enough. The pH definitely would decrease as the CO2 increases at night when the lights go off. But it's happening, you know, fairly gradually, because the lights go off and the plants stop using the CO2.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a little while to go up overnight, or the CO2 concentration goes up a bit, and then in the morning it comes, you know, changes again as soon as the lights come on, the plants start using it again. So the pH varies a little bit over the day, but it's still kind of gradual. It's not just drop them in the water and it's different. I have never had a problem with that. I've never had a problem with doing so much CO2 that it's caused stress to the organisms, or that the change that I've noticed, I mean, the organisms have been fine. No, I've never had any problems attributable to injecting CO2. Even though people do have them, I have never experienced that. And I've noticed that tetras, their colors will really pop in a tank, even with hard water that comes out of the tap at 7.8 or 8.0, you know. It's fairly alkaline water, and it's on the hard side. That putting the CO2 in there will change their color fairly quickly. Mm. You know, the neons and cardinal tetras and things like that that tend to prefer acid water. If you do the CO2 injection, you go from a fish that's kind of dull, a little washed out, to a really vibrant color a day or two after adding the CO2 injection. So that could be where you go to. I wouldn't really do both, because you want, if you do have the CO2 injection, you want to make sure you have plenty of buffering capacity. So I just leave tap water as is, and it will decrease the pH and it will increase the acidity of the water. But the buffers, you know, they're still in the water. Rather than using RO water and CO2 injection, because that could be a little more dangerous. People who use CO2 injection and with water with a low buffering capacity are more likely to run into problems. So you could go either way. I wouldn't do both.
Okay.
If that, hopefully that helps.
I'm sure.
Okay. Well, is that really where we are for this week?
I think that's everybody, yeah.
Okay, hopefully we've covered everybody, and if we need to elaborate on anything that we talked about today, then please let us know. And in the meantime, until we see you next week,
may the fish
be with you. Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and/or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.